Hello, everybody. I hope I'm in the right class. This is lecture 4 of the logic class. Now, this lecture is what I call one of the payoff lectures. That's not to say one where I'm going to give you money or you have to give me money. But what I mean by that is I mentioned at the beginning of the course that what we're doing in logic is if we have some true statements, logic enables us to get to other true statements. But so far, I haven't explained how that's done. In previous lectures, we talked about concepts and judgments and the laws of thought. We haven't actually gone over yet how we arrive at new truths. We covered fallacies and argument where I take everybody to have an ordinary language understanding of what an argument is, but we have yet to explain how arguments work, how we deduce new truths, and that's what we're going to try to do in this lecture. Now, inference, as I said, is the process of passing to a new truth. So inference is if you start off with true statements, you can get to other true statements through inference. And remember, I said at the beginning, there's three acts of the mind in this scholastic logic as opposed to symbolic logic. What we're interested in is acts of thought or people are reasoning. They have certain things going on in their mind. In mathematical or symbolic logic, we're just concerned with certain formulas. But here we're talking about acts of the mind. And you remember what the other two acts of the mind or the three acts of the mind. Conception, that having an idea of something, and then judgment. And remember, in this view, this scholastic logic and choice of system, which is the one we're using, a judgment has to have is a connection of two concepts, or denying that there's a connection of two concepts. So a judgment is always something like A is B, or it's not the case that A is B. So in judgment, there's always the verb is always is, which is called the copula. We have a term on one side that names something, and then a term on the other side that either names the same thing or denies that this other thing is the name of the first thing. So we say Socrates is a man. If you say on one side, you say term Socrates, name Socrates, and then man also named Socrates. You say Socrates is not a whale, and Socrates is naming Socrates, and not a whale is also a name of Socrates because it's a property Socrates has, namely not being a whale. So it's also, by denying this connection of a term with Socrates, you're also in effect naming Socrates. And in deduction, which is what we're concerned with in this lecture, we're moving from the general to the particular. Let's take the famous example everybody gives. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. So what we're doing is we're going from some general statement, all men are mortal, and seeing what particular statement that follows from it. Sometimes, as we'll see, we can have the conclusion can be general also, but you don't have in deduction movement from a particular to a general statement or judgment. That would be induction, which we'll cover in the last lecture. So in deduction, we're moving from general to particular. That's the way deduction works. Now, deductive inference is called a syllogism. I'm sure you've heard that term, at least I hope you've heard that term. And in a syllogism, there are three propositions. We have three, remember, proposition is the verbal expression of a judgment. So in a syllogism, we have three propositions. There's the two premises and the conclusion. I say, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. So all men are mortal and Socrates is a man are the premises, and the conclusion is Socrates is mortal. So the premises make the conclusion true. What do we mean by that? Is that if the premises are true, then the conclusion is true. Now, one thing to be very careful of, sometimes people miss it. You have to be careful when you say, the conclusion must be true. Sometimes you'll say, well, in deduction, if you reason validly, then the conclusion must be true. What you really have to be careful is that what must be true, what's necessary, is the whole statement. If the premises are true, then the conclusion is true. So if Socrates is a man, and if all men are mortal and Socrates is a man, then Socrates is mortal. So that whole statement must be true if all men are mortal and Socrates is a man, then Socrates is mortal. That's a necessary true statement. But what you have to be careful is saying Socrates is mortal must be true just by itself. You would be detaching the blue, saying that statement just by itself is necessary, and that need not be the case. Let's look at an example. Suppose we say all Keynesians are opponents of the free market. That's our first premise. Then we say Krugman is the Keynesian. And then we conclude, therefore, Krugman is an opponent of the free market. Now that's a valid argument. It follows from the premise all Keynesians are opponents of the free market, and Krugman is a Keynesian, that Krugman is an opponent of the free market. So the conclusion is true, but is it necessary? Suppose we say, is the statement Krugman is an opponent of the free market necessary? What I mean by necessary means a statement that couldn't be false. There are no imaginable circumstances in which that statement is false. If you say Krugman is an opponent of the free market, it's the question we're evaluating, is that a necessary true proposition? Just like we say 2 + 2 = 4, well, there are no possible circumstances in which 2 + 2 doesn't equal 4. But this isn't a case like that, because suppose Krugman changed his mind, suppose Krugman read Human Action and he said, oh, well, this is really great stuff. I was wrong all my life. I'm not going to be a Keynesian anymore. So that's a very unlikely thing to happen, but it seems like it's conceivable. So if that were to happen, if it's possible that Krugman changed his mind, then Krugman is an opponent of the free market is not a necessary true proposition. But the point to be aware of is it follows from these two premises that he's an opponent of the free market. So the whole inference is necessary. If the premises are true and then the conclusion is true, that whole thing is necessary, not the conclusion by itself. I'm going on about this. People very often miss that. Is everybody clear about that? But you understand the distinction between saying that what's necessary is that if the premises are true, then the conclusion follows on the one hand, On the other hand, the conclusion is necessarily true. Now, let's see, somebody has a comment here. Joe says, would it be appropriate to add the qualifier as long as Krugman remains a Keynesian? You don't need that for the conclusion because in the premise it says he's a Keynesian. So if he weren't a Keynesian, then the second premise would be false, you see. So then the conclusion would still follow validly, but you couldn't use it to establish that Krugman is an opponent of the free market. So the answer to your question is, you don't need the qualifier in this argument, the one you suggest, because it's already stated in the premise that he's a Keynesian. Now, so we now get to the question, how is it that if we start with true statements, we can get to other true statements? How is it that we're able to generate new statements that are true? Well, we can look at it this way. Say, we have, in an argument, we have two premises and a conclusion. Each premise and the conclusion is a judgment. So remember, every judgment has two terms. So we would have the first premise has two terms, second premise has two terms, and the conclusion has two terms. So how many terms are there in the whole argument if each one has two terms? Does anybody know that? We have two terms in the first premise, two terms in the second, and two terms. Well, now somebody said six, but you see, actually, my question was a bit ambiguous. I mean, not how many numerical terms there are, but how many distinct terms are there? That's three is right. You see, we do have, you know, there's a subject and predicate in each premise and also in the conclusion, but there are only three terms in the whole, that are used in the whole syllogism. So this is how we get to the new truth, because what you do in a syllogism, there's a middle term, and the middle term is the one that you don't find in the conclusion. So you have two terms, you have a term that's in both premises, but not in the conclusion. That's the middle term. So in one premise, you'll have the middle term and the predicate of the conclusion. So say we take, let's take that example again, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. So there'll be one premise that will take the predicate of the conclusion, which is mortal, and it's combined with the middle term, so that would, you would have all men are mortal. That would be the major premise, because it's taking the predicate of the conclusion, mortal, and combining it with the middle term. Then you have the other premise, you take the subject of the conclusion, which is Socrates, you combine that with the middle term. That's called the minor premise. So you have, not because it's less important, that's just the name they give. So you have Socrates is a man. So that's the middle term, is a man, but it's combined with Socrates, which is the minor premise. And major premise, you have all men, then the middle term combined with the predicate, mortal. So, again, just go over this because it's very important to get this right. I'll probably get it wrong myself because I get all these terms mixed up. but you have middle churn is the churn that doesn't occur in the conclusion. And you have each premise will have either the subject or predicate of a conclusion combined with the middle churn. The predicate combined with the middle churn is the major premise. The subject combined with the middle churn is the minor premise. Good thing I don't have to take a quiz on this. Now, let's look at some example here. Suppose we have all giraffes are married, all men are giraffes, therefore we conclude all men are married. So here, what is the middle term? Well, we look at what is the term that doesn't come in the, isn't mentioned in the conclusion, which is giraffe. So that's the middle term. It's the one that doesn't appear in the conclusion. So the major premise is all giraffes are married, because that contains the predicate of the conclusion. Remember, the conclusion is all men are married. So married is the predicate. So we look, what is the premise that has the predicate and the middle term? It's all giraffes are married. And the minor premise is all men are giraffes, because we take the subject of a conclusion, men, and then is combined with the middle term giraffe. So we have all men are giraffes is the minor premise. So the basic thing to remember is that what you're doing in an argument is you're getting a new truth, because you're saying in each premise, something is linked to the middle term. We have one thing is linked to the middle term, and one thing in the first premise, something else is linked to the middle term in the second premise. And because they're both linked to the same term, then you can get a link between the subject and predicate of the conclusion. So something like this one is linked to the same term, this other one is linked to the same term, and the two things that are linked to the same term can in turn be connected with each other. So it's once you think about it, you see it's pretty easy to grasp. Now, you now want to ask, well, why is it that connecting, that we've got this idea to say, we connect the subject and predicate of a conclusion with the middle term. Why is it that this connection enables us to arrive at a new truth? Well, what we have is the subject is included in the class of the middle term. And the middle term, in turn, is included in the class of the predicate. So let's go back and look at this example again. So we have the subject is all in men. So what we're saying is that men are included in the class of giraffes. You see that, as you say, all men are giraffes. So men is the subject term, and that's included in the class of giraffes. And then we're also saying this major premise, that the giraffes are included in the class of entities that are married. So we're saying men are included in the giraffes, and giraffes are included in the class of entities that are married. So it follows that men are in the married class. It's something like, you could think of it, maybe I should have drawn this, but I'm very bad at drawing things. I'm having enough trouble with these PowerPoints where you just type out the sentence and then you ask me to do diagrams. It's really asking too much. But you can imagine you would have the men are within the giraffes and the giraffes are within the group of married entities. So it would follow, you know, the circle, but the men would be included in the circle of the married entity. Now, I put this example because I thought it was kind of a feeble sense of humor. The one reason I picked this is, remember, when we're studying inference, we're not concerned with whether the premises are true. Of course, giraffes aren't married. Of course, it's false that men are giraffes. But what we're interested in is what follows from the premises that we're given. If these premises were true, then the conclusion would follow. So if you know you have, if you have true premises, then you can get to new truths. But I'm just using an example deliberately. I deliberately chose where the premises aren't true just so we can concentrate on the validity of the inference and see how it is that the conclusion follows. So, as I say, we see the subject is included in the class of middle term. The middle term is included in the class of the predicate. So in the example, giraffes are in the class entities that are married. Men are in the class of giraffes. So thus, men, the subject term of inclusion, is included in the class entities that are married, which is the predicate of the conclusion. Now, one thing Joyce mentioned, kind of an important point, although perhaps a bit difficult, when we say included in the class, we're talking about sort of the meaning, kind of the, we're thinking of the class not just as thinking of the things that are giraffes and the things that are men. We're considering the properties of being a man or being a giraffe. It's sort of, we're not, if they say, taking the class extensionally, we're not considering, well, this giraffe means this one, this one, this one, this one. We're kind of thinking of a giraffe, kind of the definition of a giraffe, and saying, according to this kind of weird account, giraffe, that the concept giraffe is included within the concept of married entity, rather than imagining we're listing all the giraffes and then listing all the married entities. Then we look and we see that giraffes are included among all these married entities. We're looking at the connection of concepts here. Now, remember, we were talking last time, I think they're both positive propositions, like they're A propositions. All men are mortal. That's a universal affirmative. Remember, then we have an I is some men are mortal. But we also have negative propositions. I suppose we say no man is mortal. That's called an E proposition. Or if you have an O proposition, some men are not mortal. So that's a particular negative. So if we have a negative premise in the argument, the examples I've given so far don't have a negative premise. Like we say, let's look at the hard case again so we can see this. We have all giraffes are married, all men are giraffes, therefore all men are married. So we don't have any negative premises here. So what happens if we did put in a negative premise? We have an E or an O proposition. Then the explanation of how the conclusion follows is a little different. I pick another example. Is no hippopotamus is a goalie. Maybe the hockey teams are overlooking something, or the soccer teams are overlooking something, but as far as I know, no hippopotamus is a goalie. Now we have second premise is some men are hippopotamuses, and we conclude some men are not goalies. So we ask, what's the middle term? Well, remember, the middle term is the one that doesn't occur in the conclusion. So the conclusion is some men are not holy. So we say, well, which is the middle term? Well, hippopotamus is the middle term. That doesn't appear in the conclusion. So the major premise is we take the predicate, which is goalies, and then we have a connection with hippopotamus. That would be the major premise. So the middle term here is hippopotamus, and the major premise is excluded from the class of goalies. So it says no hippopotamus is a goalie. Instead of, as in the other case, we're saying that the predicate is part is included in the middle term. Here we're saying that it's excluded. The hippopotamus is excluded from the class of goalies. Now the minor premise here says that some men are within the class of hippopotamuses. Again, you're not concerned with whether these premises are true. Although, as far as I know, no men are hippopotamuses, but here we say some men are hippopotamuses. So what would follow from that? Well, what we got here, we're first saying that hippopotamuses are excluded from the class of goalies. So unlike the other example where we say the predicate is included within the middle term, here we're saying the predicate and inclusion hippopotamus is excluded from the class of goalies. They're totally separate. In the minor premise where we connect the subject term, we're saying some men are included within the class of hippopotamuses. So all we know then, well, those men, namely the ones that are included in the hippopotamuses, can't be goalies, assuming these premises are true, because no hippopotamus is a goalie, and some men are hippopotamuses, so those men can't be goalies. So, this conclusion says that some men, the ones who are hippopotamuses, are excluded from the class of goalies that I just went over. Now, note that this leaves open whether men who are not hippos, and if there are men who aren't hippos, whether these men are goalies. And why is that? Well, remember the premise is some men are not hippopotamuses. Now that doesn't imply some men are hippopotamuses, excuse me. So that doesn't exclude the proposition all men are hippopotamuses. In logic, it could still be all men are hippopotamuses. All we're saying is some men are hippopotamuses. So it doesn't rule out that all men are, but it doesn't require that all men are hippopotamuses, just that some men are. It leaves open whether any men who aren't, or if there are men who aren't hippopotamuses, it leaves open whether those men are goalies, because it's just that we know that no hippopotamus is a goalie, but we don't know anything from these premises about entities that aren't hippopotamuses. So even if some men are hippopotamuses, then those men can't be goalies. But if it turns out they're men who aren't hippopotamuses, then for all these premises, they say it could be that those men are goalies. Now someone says, if you've ever seen Alan Ruff playing goal for Scotland, we happily swap him for a hippo. Well, I'll take your word for that. Okay, now we got that sort of basic way the syllogism works, how we get to a new truth when we start with premises that are true. I've given examples where we have premises that aren't true, just to show how the inference works. But if we can come up with true premises, then we got the conclusion. The way, again, we do that is we have to, each premise is connected to the same middle term, so that enables us to connect. You have one premise connects the middle term with the predicate of the conclusion, the other one connects the middle term with the subject of the conclusion. So because subject and predicate are connected to the same term, then you can get a connection between the subject and predicate of the conclusion. Now, if that's clear, I wish someone would explain it to me, but I think if you go over it, you'll see it's fairly straightforward. It's a bit like one way to think about it. It's an analogy you probably remember from your high school geometry classes. You have the axiom, things equal to the same thing are equal to each other. So that's using it. An application of how the syllogisms work. You think, well, since these things are equal, so the same thing, they're equal to each other. So here, if they're connected to the middle term, and two things, the subject and predicate, connected to the middle term the same way, then we can join the subject and predicate if you have the analogous way of thinking. So now, if you're going to reason correctly, you have to follow certain rules in the syllogism. Now, one of the rules, very important rule, is that the middle term has to be distributed in at least one of the premises. Now, remember, we talked about what distribution means. It doesn't mean something like giving out, like about distributive justice, distributing the prior. It has a technical meaning in logic. What we mean by distributed term is you know how much of the class the term applies to. For example, let's go back to our example. All giraffes are married. So the term giraffes is distributed in this premise because it says all giraffes. So we know that the term giraffe, we're talking about all the giraffes, so that tells us we know how much of the class we're talking about, namely the whole class. So it's not distributed, though, in the minor premise, some men are giraffes, because we don't know how much of the class of giraffes is covered by some men. Now somebody said, that's creepy, the phone in the background rang at the same time as my phone. Well, maybe somebody's calling both of us at the same time. I wish they wouldn't call during my lecture, because then, and I wonder who is it who keeps calling and I can't find out. It's the Ron Paul campaign. Well, that would be logical, but I can't distribute my attention both in the lecture and to the phone at the same time. Okay, so we see what we mean by distribution in terms of, say, some men are giraffes. Well, we don't know how much of the class of giraffes is covered by some men. You see, some men is also undistributed here because we say some men. We don't know how many men are being covered. Now, probably everybody would see some men are giraffes because it doesn't tell us how many, but the important thing, it's a little harder to see, is giraffes is also undistributed in this premise because we don't know how much of a class of giraffes we're talking about. It could be that these some men, namely the ones who are giraffes, are all the giraffes that there are, or it could be they're just a few of the giraffes that exist. We don't know that, so we don't know how many of the giraffes we're talking about. So the rule is that in the syllogism, the middle term has to be distributed in at least one of the premises. Now, if you violate this rule, you commit the famous fallacy, which is called the fallacy of the undistributed middle. This isn't to mean that the person's using the argument is too fat or has his middle going in an unusual way. It means that one of the term, the middle term is not distributed in either premise. So let's look at an example. Suppose we say all men are married. Is somebody having a problem with the camera? Hope not. It looks all right from where I'm looking. Okay, so all men are married. Some married people are divorced. All men are divorced. So what's the middle term? Well, we see which is the term that isn't in the conclusion. It's married. So married, we ask, is married distributed in the major premise? Which is the major premise here is the one, remember, it doesn't have to be the one that goes first, but on top, major premise is the one that combines the middle term, married, with the predicate of the conclusion, which is divorced. We have some married people are divorced. So married is not distributed there because we're just talking about some married people. We don't know how many. And then how about in the other premise, all men are married? Well, men is distributed, we mean all men, but the middle term, married, is not distributed because we don't know how many of the married entities there are men. So this argument doesn't work. You can see this just by looking, thinking through the reasoning, that this conclusion wouldn't be right. The premises happen to be true. All men, the first premise is false. All men are married. But even if suppose the first premise were true, all men are married, and suppose that some married people are divorced, it wouldn't follow that all men are divorced. Some men might never have been divorced. And those premises could still, the first premises could still be true. And what's wrong here is that the middle term is distributed in neither premise. Now, another requirement is if a term is distributed in the conclusion, it must be distributed in a premise. So let's look at one of my feeble attempts of humor again. We have all mortals are crazy, some men are mortal, therefore all men are crazy. So here, let's suppose we tried the test we had before. Say, is the middle term distributed? Well, what's the middle term? It's mortals, because that's the one that doesn't appear in the conclusion. So is it distributed in at least one premise? Well, let's look at some men are mortals. It isn't distributed there because we don't know how much of the class of mortals is covered by some men. So mortals isn't distributed, but it is distributed in the other premise where we said all mortals are crazy. And to avoid fallacy of undistributed middle, all you need is that the middle term is distributed in one premise. So it meets that requirement. So we don't have a fallacy of undistributed middle, but we're not out of the woods yet, because what's wrong here? Well, men is distributed in the conclusion. The term men is distributed in the conclusion, as it says, all men are crazy. But it's not distributed in the premise that mentions it, as we had that premise of some men are mortal. So that isn't saying how much of the class of men are included within the moral, which I said some men are, so we can't validly get to conclusion about all men because we just have a premise about some men. So even though we don't have fallacy when it's distributed in the middle, we still have another distribution fallacy, that a term that's distributed in the conclusion isn't distributed in the premise. Now, another requirement is that a syllogism has to have at least one general premise. Remember, in deduction, we're moving from general to particular. So if you don't have any general premise, you're not going to be able to do that. So let's look at an example of this. Let's take this, this argument. Some men are crazy. Some crazy people are Keynesian. Therefore, some men are Keynesian. So what's wrong here? Well, some men are crazy is what kind of proposition? Remember, we have A, E, I, and O. What is some men are crazy? It's what? Can anyone tell me what kind of proposition is that? It's an I. Yes, that's right, Justin. It's right. How about some crazy people are Keynesians? That's, Chris would guess that's also an I. And how about the conclusion? Some men are Keynesians. That's also not, yes. So we would have it reading I. Sounds like kind of an egotistical way of thinking. So here with this syllogism, you know, it's invalid because it doesn't have an A or an E proposition. And also, you know, we've already got invalid. This also commits a fallacy of undistributed middle because, what is the middle term? Crazy, the one that doesn't appear in the conclusion. The first premise is some men are crazy. Well, that's undistributed, doesn't tell us how many of the crazy entities are men. Second one premise is some crazy people are Keynesian. Well, that's undistributed. Also doesn't tell us how much of a class of crazy people are included within the Keynesian. So that's undistributed middle, but it's also invalid another ground that doesn't have an A or E proposition. So this syllogism has a lot wrong with it. Now, another rule is the syllogism can't have two negative premises. That can't be composed entirely of E or O propositions. And let's look at an example. So we say, no Misesians are Keynesian. That's an E. Remember, that's an E. It's a universal negative. Say, Misesians are totally excluded from the class of Keynesian. And the second premise is also an E. It says, no Keynesians are Marxists. That's saying that Keynesians are totally excluded from the class of Marxists. So the conclusion we have is no Misesians are Marxists. Now the conclusion happens to be true, but it doesn't follow from the premises. You can see why not. Because the premises just say that both Misesians and Marxists are excluded from the class of Keynesians. First premise says, imagine, say, circles again. I can't draw circles, but imagine that draw a circle of the Misesians, circle of the Keynesians. First premise says, these circles don't have any overlap in you. No Misesians are Keynesians. The second premise says, that if you make a circle of the Keynesians, a circle of Marx, it says those two circles wouldn't have any overlap. But that doesn't tell you about what the relation would be between the Misesians and Marxists. You just say both are excluded from the Keynesian King knew that, doesn't tell you about how they're related, these Essenes. Mars, of course, we know the actual world that these Essenes aren't Martians, but it wouldn't follow from these premises. Now, in Joyce's book, he gives a whole lot more of the rules than I'm covering here in the lecture, but I'm just going over a few that I think are especially important to know. Now, one that's very important is a syllogism can't contain an equivocal term. An equivocal term is one that has the same word, but it has really two meanings. So, remember, why couldn't it contain an equivocal term? Well, because remember, a syllogism has three terms in it. Remember, the subject and predicate of the conclusion, and the middle term. So if we had an equivocal term, then we'd have four terms instead of three, so we wouldn't have a proper syllogism. So let's give an example. Suppose we say all heavy objects are objects that weigh at least 10 pounds. Then we say Human Action, great book by Mises, is a heavy book. Then we conclude Human Action is an object that weighs more than 10 pounds. So what has gone wrong here? Well, heavy is used equivocally because in the first premise would mean something like heavy means having a big weight. Something is heavy, has a big weight. Like there is a wrestler I used to, in the old days, I remember from my misspent youth, named Haystack Calhoun, who weighed 625 pounds, and say he's a heavy person. But when we talk about Human Action, a heavy book, it's kind of a colloquial use, it's meaning a kind of deep book, one that requires a lot of thought and dealing with difficult subject matter. So if you say Human Action is a heavy book, you wouldn't mean one that weighs a lot, but dealing with heavy subject material, a colloquial or metaphorical sense. So the conclusion wouldn't work because you have the term heavy. Is used equivocally. Now, so those are some of the rules. I say there are a lot more that Joyce gives, but those are some of the basic rules. Now we want to go into another important thing to understand about syllogism. And this is, now if you look at Joyce's book, it's typically scholastic in that the scholastics like to elaborate extremely all sorts of classifications. They would go into every possible detail about different ways of coming up with different patterns so they can go into. So I'm just going to mention a few of the basics. I don't think we need to learn all the elaborate details of it, but if you're interested, you can read the relevant stuff in Joyce. But figure, again, we're not talking about just like a distributed middle. We're not talking about how people look. We're not talking about the person's figure. But what we mean figure is where the middle term is placed in each premise. Remember, each premise will have the middle term. The major premise will have the middle term and the predicate of the conclusion. The minor premise will have the middle term and the subject of the conclusion. But then we still have to ask, well, within each premise, where does the middle term go? In what's called the first figure, the middle term is the subject of the major premise and the predicate of the minor premise. So let's look at the example. All men, all mortals are men. All crazy beings are mortal. All crazy beings are men. So, excuse me, what's the middle term? Well, again, we say, what is the one that doesn't appear in the conclusion? It's mortal. So, what is the major premise? It's the one that combines men and mortals. So here, mortals is the subject to the major premise. All mortals are men. And the minor premise, the one that combines crazy beings, which is the subject of conclusion for the middle term mortal. Mortal is the predicate of the minor premise. So this is called the first figure. And there are four figures depending on how you arrange the middle term, that is in the subject or predicate place of each of each premise. And I'm not going to go into them all. I don't think it's important to go into that, but the scholastics classify these in this way. Now, so we've got figuring. Now, another thing we have to know, another thing we have to know is mood. Again, this isn't how you're feeling. I have to say, well, I'm feeling kind of bored now. This lecture has gone on long enough. I wish you'd hurry up and shut up. I'm kind of bored. And that isn't what we're talking about. But mood refers to the type of proposition in the syllogism that says whether A, E, I, or O. So the example I gave is what's called a valid mood. Only certain arrangements of these propositions that are valid. Let's look at the example again. Now, all mortals are men. Well, that's the universal affirmative, an A. All crazy beings are mortal. That's also an A. The conclusion, all crazy beings are men, is an A. So we have three A's. Doing pretty well in the grading here, three A's. So that's a valid mood, A. And Aristotle thought this was the most evident form of the syllogism. So that's what we mean by mood, is what are the propositions. And now we have to combine this stuff about mood. Remember what figure is the arrangement of the middle term in either subject or predicate place in the premises. And there are four figures, and it turns out that if you have a syllogism that isn't in the first figure, then you can change it to the first figure. I gave an example, A is in the first figure. There are others, example in the first figure would be EAE or AII. Those would be examples of the first figure. I didn't put those down because I don't think we really have to go into that in this course, but that's what we mean. The first figure would include certain of these ways of arranging the subject and predicate, and then if we have another figure, we can get it to the first figure. And I just mentioned this because Joyce makes a big deal of it, but for the purposes of this course, I don't think I need to do more than just mention it. Okay, so in the time remaining, remember what I want to do in the course, as I go over some of the points in Joyce's book, I want to give you an example of fallacies. So in the time we have left, I'll do that. And I think I have some pretty interesting fallacies this time that require. Some of the ones I gave in the previous lectures are pretty easy to see, but these are a bit more difficult. So here's one I get this quotation. Sir Karl Popper has pointed out that the idea that one could predict one's future knowledge is philosophically incoherent. If one could predict one's future knowledge, then one would already know it. So what Popper said is, reported by Pomeroy, correcting what he's talking, his reporting to Popper. Popper said, well, you can't predict what you're going to know in the future, because if you predicted it now, you know it now, so it wouldn't be future knowledge, so you can't predict where you're going to go in the future. Now, just out of interest, how many people think that's a good argument? You see what the argument is. You can't predict your future knowledge, because if you could predict it, it wouldn't be future knowledge. You know it now. So, does anyone want to say whether you think that's a good argument?
Well,
anybody like take a chance on that? Well, okay, I don't see that. Someone says you think he says you might know what area of knowledge we're in, not knowledge consistent in that area. Well, Keith, what if you knew it's the claim where you just know you can't know exactly what you're going to know in the future because then you know it now and not then? Would that be all right? Justin says it doesn't seem to be a good argument. You can know that you'll know something in the future. I think you're on the right track. Yes, I think you're right, as I'll try to explain. And I see Ross has termed future knowledge appears equivocal. I see, yes, that you're quite right. I see most people are saying that you can at least know a direction of things, but what I want to know is, what about not just the direction you're going on, but the exact thing you'll know? You say you can't know what you're going to know in the future because then you know it now. Well, as someone who was it who pointed this out, Ross pointed out, the argument is relying on ambiguity in the expression future knowledge, because this can mean either knowledge we don't have now but will have in the future, or it could also mean knowledge we have now but will continue to have in the future. So as long as I say, I know now that 2 plus 2 equals 4, well, probably I'll know that a week from now, so that's part of my future knowledge, 2 plus 2 equals 4. But it's not future knowledge in the sense that knowledge that I don't have now but will have in the future. So if you can predict what you will know in the future, then what you predict won't be future knowledge in the first sense, because if you're predicting it, it won't be knowledge we don't have now but will have in the future, because by hypothesis we have it now. But it can be knowledge we have now that we'll continue to have in the future. So all the argument shows is if you predict something, it isn't something you didn't predict. It doesn't actually impose any limits on what we can predict. It just appears to. It appears to be saying, oh, well, there's some limit on what we can predict, but after all, we can't predict what we're going to know in the future. But all that it's saying is, if there's something we're going to know only in the future, then that's not something we know now. That's just a tautology. If I'm going to know something only next week, then I don't know it now. But that doesn't say of any particular item of knowledge that I can't predict it, that I'm going to know it now. So, and it could be that I can predict that I'll know everything that I know in the future. In that case, there just wouldn't be any future knowledge in the first sentence, and Popper hasn't ruled that out. Okay, now next one I want to go over, this is from a quotation from Norman Podoritz in a book called World War IV. He's kind of jumping things, I guess, must have missed World War III, but he said the states of the Middle East had all been conjured into existence less than 100 years ago out of the ruins of defeated Ottoman Empire in World War I. This being the case, there was nothing utopian about the idea that such regimes, which had been planted with shallow roots by two Western powers, being Britain and France, whose legitimacy was constantly challenged by internal forces, both religious and secular, could be uprooted with the help of a third Western power and a better political system to be put in their place. So he was saying, well, you know, some people said we can't just impose democracy on Iraq or Afghanistan. We can't really, it's kind of a utopian idea to think we can impose our political system on them. So he says, well, look, you can't say that because these states just came into existence this short time ago, so how can you say it's utopian to think we can change their system into the one we want? So what's wrong here is it isn't just a non sequitur, it's something that doesn't follow. Right. It's where it doesn't follow from that that a state should be ready. Its state doesn't have deep roots that it's realistic to try to replace it with something better. Maybe you just get something else that's all you could get would be something else that wasn't so good. Or how would it follow from the fact that the state doesn't have deep roots that it isn't utopian to think you could replace it with something better? It's consistent, again, whether it's true or not is something you could you'd have to investigate in this particular case. All I'm interested here, again, is not the actual truth or falsity of what the particular situation is in the Middle East, but it's just that it doesn't follow from the fact that the state doesn't have deep roots that it's not utopian to think we can replace it with something better. Now, I now want to give another example of fallacy, which I think is a very interesting one. Again, here we're not concerned with, I know libertarians like to argue about anarchism versus minarchism and the law. We're not concerned with the substantive merits of the argument. We just want to go over the structure of an argument. Sometimes people will argue against anarchism this way. Every conflict between protection agencies requires some other agency to settle it. So therefore, there must be a central agency that is the ultimate agency to settle the dispute. So the argument is, well, when you have a conflict, you have to have some other agency to settle it. So then there has to be a central agency to settle all disputes. And someone, Chris Reed, says, this doesn't follow. I think he said, all people have a father, everyone has the same father. Well, I'm glad you gave this example because it's exactly the one I use on the next slide. So, Keith, if you didn't see the slide, you're anticipating what's going on here very well. This is called a quantifier shift fallacy. So, what we're moving from here's a fallacy is we're saying every dispute requires some agency to settle it. You're moving to there is some agency that must settle all disputes. So the first one says for every dispute we need an agency to settle that dispute. And the second one is saying we're concluding from it there's some agency that settles all disputes. Of course, it doesn't follow because it doesn't have to be the same agency that's settling all disputes. It can have different agencies settling. The first premise alone, you can have different agencies settling disputes. You can see this, again, take example, Keith is anticipating. We have everyone has a father, it doesn't imply someone is everyone's father. The first one says, for each person, that person has a father. And the conclusion says there's someone who's everyone's father. Probably be pretty busy if that were true and you'd have to be his own father. So that one's false. So you can see that's the fallacy. Okay, so I think we'll finish now. Now I'm going to go to the Q&A session. So please type your questions in there. If somebody said I gave a good lecture, well, that's it. That's a very nice thing to say. I hope people think that, especially when they're considering enrolling in my classes because it's more money for me. Thomas asks, why are Venn diagrams not used to illustrate syllogism? Well, it's certainly a very good way to illustrate syllogism. It's use Venn diagrams, but I didn't put them in. I don't really know how to draw very well. I know there's probably some ways of showing that very easily on a PowerPoint, but I didn't know how to do that. So you just have to imagine the circle by yourself. I think you can. I think Joyce gives some examples of showing these circles, but it's pretty easy to construct from what I've said. Now, I'll give you, I came across a very interesting example. I didn't put this in the lecture. I'll give you an example, but I thought it was an interesting fallacy. I go to this senior citizen gym, and I'm pretty decrepit, but I'm trying to get in a little better shape. There's a man there who said that when he was younger, he was wondering, how do we know that God exists? And he said his son was asking that. And then he said he realized God is just a concept that people have invented to for certain purposes, like to help people get along better. So described his position to conceptualism. He says he believes that God is a concept. I guess taking that to mean God is only a concept. Now, what's wrong, again, I certainly don't want to argue, not place to argue theism versus atheism, but what the fallacy I want to illustrate here is one where we talk about using a term equivocally or shifting the meaning of a term. Because say, suppose you say, I wonder whether God exists. Well, that seems like a coherent statement. Somebody could wonder whether God exists, probably. Many or most of you have asked that question. But on this conceptual position, it wouldn't be coherent to say that, because you presumably wouldn't wonder whether there's a concept of God. It would be pretty obvious there is such a concept. So what this theory is doing is redefining God so it's not having its ordinary language used, it's just substituting some other meaning of the term for the one that the ordinary language uses. Somehow you say, well, why can't you do that? Well, you certainly can, but what you have to see is it doesn't answer the question that the rich people, or he and others, are interested in, namely, does God exist? Because here we don't mean by God just the concept. So he wasn't really clear on what he was saying. So that's an example of how you can have an example of equivocation or shifting the meaning of a term. You have to be very careful about that. Gentlemen, can you have a compound proposition in a syllogism? Well, what you want to do there, you probably want to detach it in its parts. You remember, you have to have the syllogism would have to have just three judgments of a compound. One has more than one in one judgment. You have to do it. You have to take them apart and just put one in. You have to get everything in the proper form for it. So you can enjoy the system. Candy says, a previous example, use the premise, some married men are divorced. Don't married and divorced exclude each other by definition? If so, the argument could married be equivocal, you're still married versus once married. Well, that's an excellent question, Candy. I think where you would be, the term married would have to be understood there as people who have been married at one time or another. If you're certainly right someone couldn't be both married and divorced at the same time, at least if you exclude bigamous or polygamous marriages. But you're quite right, there would be. Well, let's go back to the argument so we can see what that argument is. Where was that? So we have all men are married. Here, I think what you want to say is that married is being taken in the sense of married at some time or other. So then the argument there, if you take it that way, it wouldn't involve any equivocation as long as you're taking it in the same way in the other premise that mentioned married people. So married would just be married at some time or other. But what's wrong with the argument is that married is distributed. So you're right that there is that ambiguity in what married means, but if you took the syllogism in a way, so neither premise is obviously false, then it still would be invalid because neither term is distributed. But you're right, you're certainly right, there is married can have either of those meanings. Well, I should say, in answer to Thomas's question, he said, why are Venn diagrams not used illustrated? I just answered that to mean, why didn't I put them up? Because I'm not good at trying. If you meant, why in general, why don't people use Venn diagrams illustrated? They do. I wonder where you're thinking that. In scholastic logic, you can't use Venn diagrams. I mean, that wouldn't be right, certainly. You can, and they're very helpful. Well, let's see if anybody had anything else in the chat. Well, you can try it. Where is that? I see we have quite a few things in the chat. Let me see. Oh, somebody likes my lecture. Good, good. Someone says, if the law of thermodynamics is correct, then matter is either created or destroyed, therefore the same amount has always will exist, therefore matter only changes form. Well, this is a bit outside the topic, so ignore that. It's a good question, but I'm not really confident to answer it. Justin says that Matthew example says all men and some people. I'm taking men, I guess, in that example to mean sort of a term for people. It's kind of politically incorrect, I suppose. Joanna says, when are we usually faced with your unconsidered, undistributed middle? Well, I mean, it can crop up all the time. I don't think there's a particular situation that it's especially involve it. It's just one. It just depends on the particular argument you're considering. And Joanna says, I can spot a fallacy. If you're fit, you don't need exercise. If you're sick, you don't need it. A more common one would be uh, what would it be? Now let's see, if you're sick, you don't need exercise, and if you're sick, you don't need, well, there, see, that wouldn't be an, that wouldn't be an undistributed middle. There is just an equivocal use of need, because if you say if you're fit, you don't need exercise, and you need in the sense that exercise is unnecessary, you don't need it, you're already fit, so you don't need to do anything to get, you don't require to do anything to get fit. If you say you're sick, you don't need it, means it's bad for you, so that would be an equivocal use of need there. So, more common one, well, I guess the example I gave in the lecture would be an example of undistributed middle. I mean, they come up all the time. Remember, just look for one, say, terms that, say, arguments that don't have all in them. It's a good way to, in any of the premises, or none in any of the premises, and you'll probably spot an undistributed middle. Okay, so let's see what we have here. David says, I use logical deduction in my job. I am not going out studying much formal logic. To what extent have you found this type of formal study improves or changes logical reasoning? Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, I think people can have a good common sense grasp of reasoning without studying logic formally, but I think if you do, kind of alerts you to certain fallacies and you'll be more aware of what you're doing. So I don't know of any real studies, empirical studies on this. I'd like to think it helps you on your, in your reasoning, but I certainly don't think it would hurt. Well, in times that after you rejoice, I mostly conclude that enzymes are not using formal. Oh, no, I mean, they're very good. I mean, just, I didn't use them because I'm not good at drawing. I think Joyce does give some examples, like when he's talking about the negative proposition. So he does give examples for circles, drawing circles. Now, rather than puns, we use equivocal terms. Yes, they do involve equivocal terms. Yes, that's what needed. You and your choice used Venn diagram. I remember when I was in high school, a very long time ago, some people kind of enrolled a fake student in the high school using the name John Venn. Okay, we still have about more than 11 minutes or so. Everybody understand all the points? I should say, I gave that example, you can't know future knowledge. Surprisingly, that's an extremely popular argument. There are a lot of people who give, Popper is a very important philosopher and logician, and there are many people given that argument. I mean, usually with fallacies, you think, well, you can spot a fallacy. People aren't really that good at reading. But Popper was a very good logician, but still he fell into that fallacy. Okay, let's see. Maybe there's something in the chat I could update it here. Dang, I missed them. Would it be okay with Dr. Gordon, with most of the students here, if we reschedule the final lecture class that would start 2 hours later? So we're just at the fourth lecture, just lecture 7, is that right? The other lectures would still be at this time. Yeah, that's fine with me. Yes, that's fine. That's fine with me. So that's just for lecture 7. Oh, now, Michael says, my philosophy professor argued that truth is never certain, only to a matter of degrees. Well, ask your philosophy professor, does he think it's just probable that he exists, or that 2 + 2 = 4, and why does he think that? Now, Brandon, wouldn't that be an argument for subjective? Brandon wants to know, well, the claim was that nothing is known certainly, they're just degrees of truth. No, that I don't think would be an argument for subjective truth. It would just be saying that truth is known to various degrees of certainty that all fall short of complete certainty. But that would be a different claim from saying that truth is just relative to the individual. That would be a different argument altogether. And now, one thing you might think, which wouldn't be a good argument, suppose somebody said, well, this Michael's philosophy professor said you can't know anything with certainty. Somebody would say, well, isn't he something that's self-refutating? Because wouldn't be true if he's right, that you wouldn't know that with certainty either. And that would be a good argument, because it would be right if he's correct, that we wouldn't know that, we couldn't be certain that we don't know anything for certain. But that isn't a contradiction. I mean, that would be an example of what he's contending, but there'd be nothing wrong with that. Now, Justin said, is inductive reasoning the same as a priori? No, they're more or less the opposite. Inductive reasoning is saying we can go from certain particulars to a general conclusion. Like you could say, I've given a boring lecture the first time, I'm giving a boring lecture the second time, I'm giving a boring lecture the third time. So all my lectures are going to be boring. That would be inductive reasoning. You should be going from particulars to a general conclusion. But a priori means we're reasoning from premises that we know to be true just by thinking about them. We don't have to do empirical observation, find out that they're true. Supposing I say, I exist. Well, let's take a different example. Suppose I say 2 + 2 = 4. Well, I didn't find out that that was true by counting various sets of two objects, another set of two objects, see what happens when we add them up. turned out there's always four objects. No, if I think about the 2 + 3 = 4 where I can grasp, immediately it's true, it's something I know a priori without having to, I don't require further evidence to see that it's true. So it's rather different, inductive reasoning moving from particulars to a general conclusion, a priori, or a priori reasoning from premises that you don't need to be, don't need to be confirmed by evidence. Well, now Chris was raised that point, he certainly was uncertain. Now that's a good question, but he, if he's not, he's perfectly consistent. So now, Keith says a bit like positive knowing, I think about things that we can't know about the world by thinking about them. Well, if you know the positivists really are involved in the contradiction there, they say we can only know certain types of propositions, and that statement is an example of the kinds they think we can know. But this other view isn't directly contradictory, because we can't be certain about anything. Well, it's perfectly consistent to say we can't be certain about anything, including that statement, we can't be certain about anything. Now, Joanna says, I think truth is a certain category, if you know it's another matter. You're certainly right, Joanna, that truth and knowledge are different things. Now, Michael says, I guess there's no absolute certainty that I exist. Well, we're asking who said that. Am I sure about that statement? Which statement? Solipsism doubts their own existence. Yes, you remember the one, the Mrs. Ladd Franklin was an early 20th century logician, supposed to have written to Bertrand Russell that she thought the case for solipsism was so good that she wondered why there weren't more of them. John says there are absolutely no absolutes is in itself an absolute. Well, that, Joanna, you're certainly right, that one would get you into a contradiction. But the one I was considering is a somewhat different claim, is we can't be certain of anything. So suppose you say, well, we can't be certain of anything, including the statement that we can't be certain of anything. And I don't see that that's a contradiction at all. Just an example of something we can't be certain of. So the person who's advancing that would get into a contradiction. Well, I'm certain we can't be certain anything of anything. But he need not be saying that. He could just be saying we're not certain of anything, including that very statement. So to say to him, oh, but look, why are you saying that if you yourself admit you can't be certain? He said, well, I think there are good reasons to hold that view. I'm not certain of them, but there are good reasons to hold it. So it doesn't seem to me would be involved in any contradiction. So, Joanne, I don't think this, I mean, the statement you gave is undermined. There are absolutely no absolutes, but we can't be certain of anything, I don't think, is subject to a similar kind of self-referential fallacy. Yes, Joanna said, well, yes, I think that's a good example. I mean, there's certainly, you're in pain as well. You should, if you've been listening to this lecture all the time, you can be certain of that. So I don't think it's a very plausible view to say they're not certain of anything. Well, okay, I guess if you can't be certain of this, now Chris has said if you can't be certain of a statement, why even say it? Well, suppose you said something like, for example, I think Ron Paul is going to do well in the Ohio primary. So I don't think it would be an unreasonable thing to say, but I'm not certain of it. I mean, I don't think there's any reason to restrict your statements to ones you're certain of. But, okay, well, I'm not certain of it, but I think we're out of time. We finished the lecture now, so thank you, everybody. So next week, O'Keefe has good one. Can the sponsors object to receiving an F grade if they deny that anyone else exists to see it? Well, yeah, he could, because just be talking to himself, I suppose. He just said, I don't like getting an F grade. Okay, so now next week we'll be meeting at the usual time. So it's just lecture 7. Oh, thank you, Mike. We'll just be lecture 7 is a different time. And I want to remind, in case anyone is in my other class, which is the History of Economic Thought, that class will be tomorrow, not Wednesday, because Wednesday I'm supposed to be in transit to Auburn. So the class, my economic thought class, will be tomorrow at the usual time, which is 8:15 Eastern time. So that's tomorrow. But now we don't have to worry about lecture 7 of the History of Thought class, because there isn't a lecture 7 of the History of Thought class. Now, I hope everybody's totally confused. I know I am. Okay, thank you, everybody.